signs of individual failings, and that there was an out-of-control feral underclass that needed to be brought firmly under control. I felt that the riots magnified a number of the issues explored in Chaffs. Weeks after calm had returned to England's streets, facts emerged that challenged the dominant narrative. Ian Duncan Smith had blamed gang culture, yet only 13% of those arrested were members of gangs. But according to the government's own figures, 42% of the young people involved were eligible for free school meals, more than 2.5 times the national average. The adults arrested were almost 3 times as likely to be on out-of-work benefits as the population as a whole. Nearly 2/3 of the young rioters lived in England's poorest areas. Here, then, was a sliver of Britain's burgeoning young poor. It would be simplistic to argue a straightforward cause and effect, that unemployment and poverty had provoked the unrest. After all, the vast majority of people who were out of work or poor did not riot. But there are growing numbers of young people in Britain with no secure future to risk. Youth unemployment is running at over 20%. There is a crisis of affordable housing, the biggest cut since the 1920s, and falling living standards. University tuition fees have trebled, and the educational maintenance allowance for students from poor backgrounds has been scrapped. Many young people have been left with very little to hope for. For the first time since World War II, the next generation will be worse off than the generation before it. Of course, we all have agency. We don't all respond to the same situation in the same way, but it only takes a small proportion of young people who have nothing much to lose to bring chaos to the streets. It is also impossible to ignore the fact that men featured so prominently among the rioters. 9 out of 10 apprehended rioters were men. Britain's rapid deindustrialization and the disappearance of so many skilled middle-income jobs were particularly disruptive, given that such work often excluded women, to the lives of working-class men. Over a generation ago, a young working-class man could leave school at the age of 16 and have a decent prospect of getting an apprenticeship, training that might open a gateway to a skilled, respected job that could give life some structure. But when the jobs and the apprenticeships that supported them disappeared, there was nothing to take their place. Although the old industrial heartlands are generally associated with mining and manufacturing areas in the north, industry disappeared in parts of the south too. Hundreds of thousands of mostly light industrial jobs disappeared in London and southern England. In October 2011, the government's cabinet office published a report on the riots based on interviews in 5 of the worst-hit areas. In Tottenham, for example, the report found that decline in local industry and subsequently in retail on its high street were factors seen as being responsible for the lack of jobs. Interviewees described the hopelessness of some young people in the face of limited opportunities. Again, this disappearance of opportunities has affected a large proportion of young working-class men, the overwhelming majority of whom did not riot. But with so many leaving school with nothing much to look forward to, it should not be all that surprising if a small minority should respond to their bleak prospects in this way. A toxic combination of inequality and consumerism also undoubtedly played its part. In 1979, Britain was one of the most equal Western societies. After 3 decades of Thatcherism, it is now one of the least equal. The Gini coefficient, which measures levels of inequality in a society, has shot up from 0.25 to 0.40 in 3 decades. London is one of the most unequal cities on earth. The richest 10% is worth 273 times more than the poorest 10%. London is not, yet, like Paris, where the affluent are concentrated in the centre, and the poorest are more likely to be found in the banlieue, the suburbs. In London, the rich and the poor live almost on top of each other. On a daily basis, the least well-off are able to see what they will never have. Take Clapham Junction, one of the scenes of August 2011's riots. A railway separates the affluent south from deprived estates to the north. If they, young people, ever wanted reminding of what they don't have, this is a good place to be, one community stakeholder told the Cabinet Office investigators. Britain is a hyper-consumerist society. Status has so much to do with what we own or wear. The vast majority of young people want to be part of this consumerism, but many face huge financial obstacles. What surprised me least of all about the looting was the targeting of trainers. When I was growing up, they were a huge status symbol. To have an unfashionable pair could bring ridicule. No wonder, then, that Foot Locker was looted while more upmarket stores were simply burned to the ground. The goods may have been worth more, but they had no relevance to the lives of young people. They brought no status. Hostility towards the police was an important factor, too. Since the riots, I have spoken to a number of young black men about their experiences with the police. Like me, they have never been charged with an offence. But there was one major difference. While I have never been stopped and searched by the police, it was an experience they have all endured throughout their lives. One told me that he was first stopped and searched at the age of 12, when he was on his way to buy milk for his mother. Sometimes the police officers were sympathetic or even almost apologetic. At other times they were aggressive or threatening. Some officers acted as if, "We're the biggest gang around here," a sentiment that cropped up in interviews with convicted rioters. Indeed, interviews with rioters conducted by the Reading the Riot study, a collaboration between the LSE, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and The Guardian, found that rioters identified anti-police sentiment as the biggest single cause of the unrest. Of course, many of the rioters got involved because they saw an opportunity to steal with impunity. For others, it was a vicarious thrill, a chance to show off in front of friends, and to be able to boast that they were a part of the action. Some just got caught up in a crowd, sensing that accepted social norms had temporarily been suspended. Others looked at the shameless greed of the bankers and politicians, feeling that if those at the top could get away with it, why couldn't they? And there were others who felt frustrated, angry, disillusioned, or bored. The specific motives varied from case to case. For some, there was a combination of reasons. But what united the rioters and looters of England's hot August was that there was not much for them to put at risk, and a lack of faith in, or outright antipathy towards, the local police. No one can predict whether there will be a new wave of riots, but it is certain that the most drastic cut since the 1920s will have a devastating impact on Britain's social fabric. Growing numbers of people, of all ages, will inevitably have a mounting sense that there is a bleak future ahead. In those circumstances, anger and frustration will surely only increase, and unless it is organized and given political direction, it could manifest itself in the ugliest of ways. 2011 was a year of turmoil across the globe, not least because of a deepening economic crisis, and the courage and determination of millions of Arabs in rising up against the brutal, senile tyrannies that ruled over them. This new era of unrest represented another shift taking place, one with profound implications for my arguments. Chavs is, in large part, a story about the legacy of defeat, that is, the consequences of the pounding suffered by the British labour movement and many working-class communities in the 1980s. I argue that the demonization identified was the flagrant triumphalism of the rich, who, no longer challenged by those below them, instead point and laugh at them. But even as Chavs was published, this triumphalism was under attack. At the end of 2011, Time magazine named The Protester as its person of the year. Indeed, whether it was uprisings against murderous despots or mass demonstrations against austerity, the protest made one of its biggest comebacks since the 1960s, including in Britain, which experienced waves of demonstrations, occupations, and strikes. Although as yet there has been no sustained challenge to the position of the wealthy elites, it has once more become clear that it is possible to resist. In Britain, the new age of dissent arrived on the 10th of November 2010, when the National Union of Students called a demonstration against the proposed trebling of tuition fees. Only 20,000 or so were expected to turn up. The actual number on the day was around 52,000. Most of those who were taken to the street were newly politicized, and they found the experience of marching alongside young people both exhilarating and empowering. A section of the demonstration occupied Westminster's Millbank Tower, where the Conservative Party has offices. Although the scenes became the focus of a self-righteous media, eager to condemn violence, even though there was hardly any, the Millbank occupation became a symbol of resistance for many radicalized young people. Despite the lack of support from the National Union of Students' leadership, the following week saw a series of protests, while dozens of occupations were staged at universities across the country. Amid all the moral outrage and focus on smashed windows, the media missed one of the most interesting elements of the protests. Many of the most vocal, determined protesters were not middle-class students, but working-class teenagers who were furious at the scrapping of the educational maintenance allowance, means-tested government subventions given to those from poorer backgrounds to keep them in education. Many of them felt that a government of millionaires was slamming the door in their faces. Previously, they had been dismissed as, at best, an apathetic mass with few interests outside the X Factor and iPhones, and, at worst, a social threat that had to be contained. But here they were, politically astute, indignant, and determined to make their long-ignored voices heard. The students did not stop the government forcing the trebling of tuition fees through Parliament, but the myth of British passivity was shattered. Trade unions, still drastically weakened and lacking in confidence, looked on at the protesting students with more than a little interest. In the words of Len McCluskey, leader of Unite, the biggest trade union in the country, the students had put trade unions on the spot. In 2011, the union's turn came. As austerity began biting into jobs and living standards, the trade union movement called on people to march for the alternative on the 26th of March 2011. It was the biggest workers' protest for over a generation. Here was a cross-section of the modern British working class, hundreds of thousands strong, standing up to a government that was forcing them to pay for a crisis they had no role in causing. The protest marked the beginning of a new wave of trade union resistance. After assuming office, the Conservative-led government announced so-called reforms to public sector pensions, reforms being a term that had long since changed in meaning from social progress to rolling it back. Arguing that public sector pensions were becoming unaffordable, the government unveiled plans to make workers pay more and work longer for their pensions and receive less. Yet a recently commissioned government report written by ultra-Blairite ex-Labour Minister John Hutton revealed that public sector pensions would fall as a proportion of Britain's economy. In other words, they were set to become more affordable. In any case, the extra money raised was not intended to bolster pension funds, but to flow straight into the Treasury's coffers. This was, in fact, a deficit tax being imposed on public sector workers, from dinner ladies to teachers. Exploiting the fact that private sector pension coverage had collapsed over the previous decade, the government attempted to play divide-and-rule politics, a strategy amplified across the media. Why, the argument went, should private sector workers with comparatively meagre pensions subsidise the generous settlements of the public sector? There was no doubt that there had been a collapse in private sector pension provision. At the beginning of 2012, the Association of Consulting Actuaries warned that 9 out of 10 private sector-defined benefit schemes were closed to new entrants. But what was being proposed was a race to the bottom. Public sector pensions should be dragged down, not private sector pensions dragged up. The majority of public sector workers saw this rhetoric for what it really was. On the 30th of June 2011, hundreds of thousands of teachers and civil servants went on strike. But with the government still refusing to make significant concessions, trade union ballots across the public sector delivered overwhelming support for industrial action. On the 30th of November, lollipop ladies, bin collectors, nurses, and other workers went on strike. It was the biggest wave of industrial action since the 1926 general strike. After all the many obituaries written about the trade union movement, the collective power of working people was back on the agenda. Other movements, too, helped put class back on the agenda. In October 2011, anti-austerity protesters occupied Wall Street in the United States. They were, in part, inspired by the Spanish indignados, outraged, who had occupied Madrid's main square the previous May in protest at the Spanish government's response to the banking crisis. They, in turn, had followed the example of Egyptian revolutionaries who had taken Cairo's Tahrir Square. The New York protests spawned a global Occupy movement, as similar camps were set up in hundreds of cities across the globe, including London, where tents were erected outside St. Paul's Cathedral. The key slogan of the Occupy movement, "We are the 99%, reflected that the interests of the overwhelming majority of people conflicted with those of the elite 1% at the top. It may not have been an accurate figure, but that wasn't the point. The slogan tapped into a deep sense of injustice that had taken root since the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008. Above all, it served as a reminder of who had caused the economic crisis and who was actually being made to pay for it. And it resonated. A poll conducted by ICM in October 2011 revealed that 38% believed, "The protesters are naive. There is no practical alternative to capitalism. The point is to get it moving again." But another 51% agreed that, "The protesters are right to want to call time on a system that puts profit before people." Britain remains in the middle of an apparently intractable crisis. As things stand, the position of the wealthy elite remains strong the world over, and the future looks incredibly bleak for millions of working people. But I passionately believe that hope lies in a return to class politics, that is, a rejection of the fiction that we're all in this together, and a recognition that while working people share basic common interests, they're on a collision course with the interests of those at the top. Chavs wasn't about pity or nostalgia. It was about power. Above all else, it sought to highlight the central crisis of modern politics, the lack of working-class political representation. Only an organized movement of working people can challenge the economic madness that threatens the future of large swathes of humanity. But such a movement is impossible unless a number of myths are debunked. That we're all essentially middle class, that class is an outdated concept, and that social problems are the failings of the individual. My book is one contribution to taking on those myths. However, social change does not come through the scribblings of sympathetic writers, but through mass pressure from below. As an ideologically charged austerity program inflicts hardship on communities across the country, there will surely be a growing determination to fight for an alternative. The Tories, unreconstructed Blairites, and their wealthy backers would be reckless to imagine they have already won. There is still all to play for. February 2012. Introduction. It's an experience we've all had. You're among a group of friends or acquaintances when suddenly someone says something that shocks you, an aside or a flippant comment made in poor taste. But the most disquieting part isn't the remark itself. It's the fact that no one else seems the slightest bit taken aback. You look around in vain, hoping for even a flicker of concern or the hint of a cringe. I had one of those moments at a friend's dinner in a gentrified part of East London one winter evening. The blackcurrant cheesecake was being carefully sliced, and the conversation had drifted to the topic of the moment, the credit crunch. Suddenly, one of the hosts tried to raise the mood by throwing in a light-hearted joke. "It's sad that Woolworths is closing. Where will all the chavs buy their Christmas presents?" Now, he was not someone who would ever consider himself to be a bigot. Neither would anyone else present, for, after all, they were all educated and open-minded professionals. Sitting around the table were people from more than one ethnic group. The gender split was 50-50, and not everyone was straight. All would have placed themselves somewhere left of centre politically. They would have bristled at being labelled a snob. If a stranger had attended that evening and disgraced him or herself by bandying around a word like packy or puff, they would have found themselves swiftly ejected from the flat. But no one flinched at a joke about Chavs shopping in Woolies. To the contrary, everybody laughed. I doubt that many would have known that this derogatory term originates from the Romany word for child, chavi. Neither were they likely to have been among the 100,000 readers of the Little Book of Chavs, an enlightened tome that describes Chavs as the burgeoning peasant underclass. If they had picked it up from a bookshop counter for a quick browse, they would have learned that Chavs tend to work as supermarket checkout cashiers, fast-food restaurant workers, and cleaners. Yet deep down, everyone must have known that Chav is an insulting word, exclusively directed against people who are working class. The joke could easily have been rephrased as, "It's sad that Woolworths is closing. Where will the ghastly lower classes buy their Christmas presents?" And yet it wasn't even what was said that disturbed me the most. It was who said it, and who shared in the laughter. Everyone sitting around that table had a well-paid professional job. Whether they admitted it or not, they owed their success, above all, to their backgrounds. All grew up in comfortable middle-class homes, generally out in the leafy suburbs. Some were educated in expensive private schools. Most had studied at universities like Oxford, LSE, or Bristol. The chances of someone from a working-class background ending up like them were, to say the least, remote. Here I was, witnessing a phenomenon that goes back hundreds of years, the wealthy mocking the less well-off. And it got me thinking, how has hatred of working-class people become so socially acceptable? Privately educated multimillionaire comedians dress up as chavs for our amusement in popular sitcoms such as Little Britain. Our newspapers eagerly hunt down horror stories about life among the chavs, and pass them off as representative of working-class communities. Internet sites such as Chav Scum brim with venom directed at the chav caricature. It seems as though working-class people are the one group in society that you can say practically anything about. You would be hard-pushed to find someone in Britain who hates chavs as much as Richard Hilton. Mr. Hilton is the chief executive of Gymbox, one of the trendier additions to London's flourishing fitness scene. Known for its creatively titled gym classes, Gymbox is unashamedly aimed at fitness freaks with deep pockets, demanding a steep £175 joining fee on top of £72 a month for membership. As Mr. Hilton himself explains, Gymbox was launched to tap into the insecurities of its predominantly white-collar professional clientele. Members were asking for self-defense classes as they were scared living in London, he says. In spring 2009, Gymbox unveiled a new addition to its already eclectic range of classes, including boob aerobics, pole dancing, and bitch boxing. Chav fighting. "Don't give moody, grunting chavs an asbo," its website urged. "Give them a kicking." The rest of the promotional spiel did not pull its punches either, in the voice of a vigilante with a good grasp of PR. "Forget stealing candy from a baby. We'll teach you how to take Bacardi off a hoodie and turn a grunt into a whine. Welcome to Chav Fighting, a place where the punch bags gather dust and the world is put to rights." The leaflets were even more candid. "Why hone your skills on punch bags and planks of wood when you can deck some chavs? A world where Bacardi breezes are your sword and asbos are your trophy." There were some who felt that glorifying beating people up might be overstepping the mark. When the Advertising Standards Authority was called in, Gymbox responded with technicalities. It was not offensive, they claimed, because nobody in society would admit to being a chav. It was not a group to which people wanted to belong. Amazingly, the ASA cleared Gymbox on the basis that chav fighting classes would be unlikely to condone or incite violence against particular social groups. You would have to speak to Richard Hilton to appreciate the depths of hatred that inspired the class. Defining chavs as young Burberry-clad street kids, he went on to explain, They tend to live in England, but would probably pronounce it Ingerland. They have trouble articulating themselves, and have little ability to spell or write. They love their pit bull dogs as well as their blades, and would happily shank you if you accidentally brush past them or look at them in the wrong way. They tend to breed by the age of 15 and spend most of their days trying to score super skunk or whatever gear they can get their sweaty teenage hands on. If they're not institutionalized by 21, they're considered pillars of strength in the community or get much respect for being lucky. It's no surprise that when asked if so-called chavs were getting a hard time in Britain, his response was blunt. No, they deserve it. Apparently the class was a hit with gymgoers, describing it as one of the most popular classes we've ever run. He claimed that most people related to it and enjoyed it. A few of the PC brigade were offended by it. And yet, intriguingly, Mr. Hilton does not think of himself as a bigot. Far from it. Sexism, racism, and homophobia, for example, were completely unacceptable. An extremely successful businessman, Richard Hilton has tapped into the fear and loathing felt by some middle-class Londoners towards the lower orders. It is a compelling image, sweating city bankers taking out their recession-induced frustrations on semi-bestial poor kids. Welcome to Gymbox, where class war meets personal fitness. It is easy to gasp at Hilton's unembarrassed hatred, but he has crudely painted a widespread middle-class image of the working-class teenager, thick, violent, criminal, breeding like animals. And, of course, these chavs are not isolated elements. They are, after all, regarded as pillars of strength in the community. Gymbox isn't the only British company to have exploited middle-class horror of large swathes of working-class Britain. Activities Abroad is a travel firm offering exotic adventure holidays with price tags often upwards of £2,000. Husky safaris in the Canadian wilderness, Finnish log cabin holidays, that sort of thing. Oh, but chavs need not apply. In January 2009, the company sent a promotional email to the 24,000 people on its database, quoting a Daily Mail article from 2005 showing that children with middle-class names were 8 times more likely to pass their GCSEs than those with names like Wayne and Dwayne. The findings had led them to wonder what sort of names were likely to be found on an Activities Abroad trip. So the team had a trawl through their database and came up with 2 lists, one of names you are likely to encounter on one of their holidays and one of those you were not. Alice, Joseph and Charles featured on the first list, but Activities Abroad excursions were a Brittany, Chantelle and Dazza free zone. They concluded that they could legitimately promise chav-free activity holidays. Again, not everyone was amused, but the company was unrepentant. "I simply feel it is time the middle classes stood up for themselves," declared Managing Director Alistair McLean. "Regardless of whether it's class warfare or not, I make no apology for proclaiming myself to be middle class." When I spoke to Barry Nolan, one of the company's directors, he was equally defiant. The great indignation came from Guardian readers who were showing false indignation because they don't live near them, he said. It resonated with the sort of people who were likely to be booking holidays with us. It proved to be an overwhelming success with our client base. Apparently, the business enjoyed a 44% increase in sales in the aftermath of the furore. Gymbox and Activities Abroad had taken slightly different angles. Gymbox were tapping into middle-class fears that their social inferiors were a violent mob waiting to knife them to death in some dark alley. Activities Abroad exploited resentment against the cheap flights which allowed working-class people to invade the middle-class space of the foreign holiday. You can't even flee abroad to escape them these days. That sort of sentiment. But both of them were evidence of just how mainstream middle-class hatred of working-class people is in modern Britain. Chav bashing has become a way of making money because it strikes a chord. This becomes still more obvious when an unrepresentative story in the headlines is used as a convenient hook to prove the anti-chav narrative. When ex-convict Raoul Moat went on the run after shooting dead his ex-lover's partner in July 2010, he became an anti-hero for a minority of some of the country's most marginalized working-class people. One criminologist, Professor David Wilson, told Sky News Moat was tapping into that dispossessed white working-class masculine mentality, whereby they can't make their way into the world legitimately, so behaving the way that Moat has behaved, as this kind of anti-hero, has, I think, touched a nerve. White working-class men had at a stroke been reduced to knuckle-dragging thugs lacking legitimate aspirations. The internet hosted a vitriolic free-for-all. Take this comment on the Daily Mail site. Look around the supermarket, the bus, and increasingly now on the road, you will encounter ever-growing numbers of tattooed, loud, foul-mouthed proles with scummy brats trailing in their wake, who are incapable of acknowledging or even recognizing a common courtesy, and who, in their own minds, can never, ever be in the wrong about anything. These are the people who are getting sentimental about a vicious killer. They have no values, no morality, and are so thick that they're beyond redemption. You are better off just avoiding them. This form of class hatred has become an integral, respectable part of modern British culture. It is present in newspapers, TV comedy shows, films, internet forums, social networking sites, and everyday conversations. At the heart of the Chavs phenomenon is an attempt to obscure the reality of the working-class majority. "We're all middle class now," runs the popular mantra. All except for a feckless, recalcitrant rump of the old working class. Simon Heffer is a strong advocate of this theory. One of the most prominent right-wing journalists in the country, he has often argued that something called the respectable working class has almost died out. What sociologists used to call the working class does not now usually work at all, but is sustained by the welfare state. It has given way to what he calls a feral underclass. When I asked him what he meant by this, he replied, "The respectable working class has died out, largely for good reason, because it was aspirational, and because society still provided the means of aspiration. They had moved up the social ladder because they've gone to university, and they've got jobs in white-collar trades or professions, and they've become middle class. Where the millions who remain in manual occupations, or the majority of the population who have not attended a university, fit into all this is an interesting question." According to Heffer, however, there are really two main groups in British society. You don't have families anymore that live in sort of respectable, humble circumstances for generation after generation. They either become clients of the welfare state and become the underclass, or they become middle class. This is the model of society as seen through Heffer's eyes. Nice middle-class people on one side, an unredeemable detritus on the other, the underclass, who represent that section of the working class that not only has no ambition, it has no aspiration, and nothing in between. It bears no relation to how society is actually structured. But then why would it? After all, the journalists producing this stuff have little, if any, contact with the people they disparage. Heffer has a thoroughly middle-class background, lives in the country and sends his kids to Eton. At one point he admits, "I don't know a great deal about the underclass," a fact that has not deterred him from repeatedly slagging them off. There are some who defend the use of the word chav and claim that actually working-class people are not demonized at all. Chav is simply used to designate antisocial hooligans and thugs. This is questionable. To begin with, no one can doubt that those on the receiving end are exclusively working class. When chav first appeared in the Collins English Dictionary in 2005, it was defined as a young working class person who dresses in casual sports clothing. Since then, its meaning has broadened significantly. One popular myth makes it an acronym for Council Housed and Violent. Many use it to show their distaste towards working-class people who have embraced consumerism, only to spend their money in supposedly tacky and uncivilized ways, rather than with the discreet elegance of the bourgeoisie. Celebrities from working-class backgrounds such as David Beckham, Wayne Rooney or Cheryl Cole, for example, are routinely mocked as chavs. Above all, the term chav now encompasses any negative traits associated with working-class people: violence, laziness, teenage pregnancies, racism, drunkenness, and the rest. As Guardian journalist Zoe Williams wrote, "Chav might have grabbed the popular imagination by seeming to convey something original, not just scum friends, but scum in Burberry, only now it covers so many bases as to be synonymous with prole, or any word meaning poor, and therefore worthless." Even Christopher House, a leader writer for the conservative Daily Telegraph, objected that many people use chav as a smokescreen for their hatred of the lower classes. To call people chavs is no better than public schoolboys calling townies oiks. Chavs are often treated as synonymous with the white working class. The BBC's 2008 White Season of programmes dedicated to the same class was a classic example, portraying its members as backward-looking, bigoted, and obsessed with race. Indeed, while the working class became a taboo concept in the aftermath of Thatcherism, the white working class was increasingly spoken about in the early 21st century. Because class had for so long been a forbidden word within the political establishment, the only inequalities discussed by politicians and the media were racial ones. The white working class had become another marginalized ethnic minority, and this meant that all their concerns were understood solely through the prism of race. They became presented as a lost tribe on the wrong side of history, disorientated by multiculturalism and obsessed with defending their identity from the cultural ravages of mass immigration. The rise of the idea of a white working class fueled a new liberal bigotry. It was okay to hate the white working class because they were themselves a bunch of racist bigots. One defense of the term chav points out that chavs themselves used the word, so what's the problem? They have a point. Some young working-class people have even embraced the word as a cultural identity. But the meaning of a word often depends on who is using it. When uttered by a heterosexual, queer is clearly deeply homophobic. Yet some gay men have proudly appropriated it as an identity. Similarly, although packy is one of the most offensive racist terms a white person can use in Britain, some young Asians use it as a term of endearment among their peers. In 2010, a controversy involving right-wing US shock jock Dr. Laura Schlesinger vividly illustrated this point. After using the word nigger on air 11 times in a conversation with an African-American caller, she attempted to defend herself on the grounds that black comedians and actors used it. In all cases, the meaning of the word changes depending on the speaker. When uttered by a middle-class person, chav becomes a term of pure class contempt. Liam Cranley, the son of a factory worker who grew up in a working-class community in Greater Manchester, describes to me his reaction when a middle-class person uses the word. "You're talking about family. You're talking about my brother. You're talking about my mum. You're talking about my friends." This book will look at how chav hate is far from an isolated phenomenon. In part, it is the product of a deeply unequal society. In my view, one of the key effects of greater inequality is to increase feelings of superiority and inferiority in society, says Richard Wilkinson, co-author of the seminal The Spirit Level, a book that effectively demonstrates the link between inequality and a range of social problems. And indeed, inequality is much greater today than it has been for most of our history. A widespread inequality is an extremely recent thing for most of the world, argues the professor of human geography and inequality expert Danny Dorling. Demonizing people at the bottom has been a convenient way of justifying an unequal society throughout the ages. After all, in the abstract, it would seem irrational that through an accident of birth, some should rise to the top while others remain trapped at the bottom. But what if you're on top because you deserve to be? What if people at the bottom are there because of a lack of skill, talent, and determination? Yet it goes deeper than inequality. At the root of the demonization of working-class people is the legacy of a very British class war. Margaret Thatcher's assumption of power in 1979 marked the beginning of an all-out assault on the pillars of working-class Britain. Its institutions, like trade unions and council housing, were dismantled. Its industries, from manufacturing to mining, were trashed. Its communities were, in some cases, shattered, never to recover, and its values, like solidarity and collective aspiration, were swept away in favour of rugged individualism. Stripped of their power and no longer seen as a proud identity, the working class was increasingly sneered at, belittled, and scapegoated. These ideas have caught on, in part because of the eviction of working class people from the world of the media and politics. Politicians, particularly in the Labour Party, once spoke of improving the conditions of working class people, but today's consensus is all about escaping the working class. The speeches of politicians are peppered with promises to enlarge the middle class. Aspiration has been redefined to mean individual self-enrichment, to scramble up the social ladder and become middle class. Social problems like poverty and unemployment were once understood as injustices that sprang from flaws within capitalism, which, at the very least, had to be addressed. Yet today they have become understood as the consequences of personal behaviour, individual defects, and even choice. The plight of some working-class people is commonly portrayed as a poverty of ambition on their part. It is their individual characteristics rather than a deeply unequal society, rigged in favour of the privileged, that is held responsible. In its extreme form, this has even led to a new social Darwinism. According to the evolutionary psychiatrist Bruce Charlton, poor people have a lower average IQ than wealthier people, and this means that a much smaller percentage of working-class people than professional-class people will be able to reach the normal entrance requirements of the most selective universities. The Chav caricature is set to be at the heart of British politics in the years ahead. After the 2010 general election, a Conservative-led government, dominated by millionaires, took office with an aggressive programme of cuts, unparalleled since the early 1920s. The global economic crisis that began in 2007 may have been triggered by the greed and incompetence of a wealthy banking elite, yet it was working-class people who were, and are, expected to pay the price. But any attempt to shred the welfare state is fraught with political difficulties, and so the government swiftly resorted to blaming its users. Take Jeremy Hunt, a senior Conservative minister with an estimated wealth of £4.1 million. To justify the slashing of welfare benefits, he argued that long-term claimants had to take responsibility for the number of children they had, and that the state would no longer fund large workless families. In reality, just 3.4% of families in long-term receipt of benefits have four children or more. But Hunt was tapping into the age-old prejudice that the people at the bottom were breeding out of control, as well as conjuring up the tabloid caricature of the slobbish single mother who milks the benefit system by having lots of children. The purpose was clear: to help justify a wider attack on some of the most vulnerable working-class people in the country. The aim of this book is to expose the demonization of working-class people, but it does not set out to demonize the middle class. We are all prisoners of our class, but that does not mean we have to be prisoners of our class prejudices. Similarly, it does not seek to idolize or glorify the working class. What it proposes is to show some of the reality of the working-class majority that has been airbrushed out of existence in favor of the Chav caricature. Above all, this book is not simply calling for a change in people's attitudes. Class prejudice is part and parcel of a society deeply divided by class. Ultimately, it is not the prejudice we need to tackle. It is the fountain from which it springs. Chapter 1. The Strange Case of Shannon Matthews. Every middle-class person has a dormant class prejudice which needs only a small thing to arouse it. The notion that the working class have been absurdly pampered, hopelessly demoralized by doles, old-age pensions, free education, etc., is still widely held. It has merely been a little shaken, perhaps, by the recent recognition that unemployment does exist. George Orwell, The Road to Wigan Pier. Why does the life of one child matter more than another's? On the face of it, the disappearances of Madeleine McCann in May 2007 and of Shannon Matthews in February 2008 bore striking similarities. Both victims were defenceless little girls. Both vanished without a trace, Madeleine from her bedroom while she slept, Shannon on the way home from a swimming class. Both cases featured tearful televised appeals from the devastated mothers, clutching the favourite toys of their beloved daughters, begging for their safe return. It is true that while Madeleine disappeared in an upmarket holiday resort in the Portuguese Algarve, Shannon vanished from the streets of Dewsbury in West Yorkshire. And yet in both cases, the public was faced with the same incomparable anguish of a mother who had lost her child. But there were more than 9 months and a few hundred miles separating the two cases. After a fortnight, British journalists had penned 1,148 stories devoted to Madeleine McCann. The stunning sum of £2.6 million had been offered as a reward to have her returned to her parents. Prominent donors included the News of the World and the Sun newspapers, Sir Richard Branson, Simon Cowell, and J.K. Rowling. The missing infant quickly became a household name. The McCann disappearance was no ordinary media circus. The case became a national trauma. Like some sort of macabre reality TV show, every little detail was beamed into the living rooms of a transfixed British public. News broadcasters sent their most celebrated anchors to report live from the Algarve. Posters with close-ups of her distinctive right eye went up in shop windows across the country, as though somehow the bewildered three-year-old would be found wandering the streets of Dundee or Aberystwyth. Members of Parliament wore yellow ribbons in solidarity. Multinational companies advertised the Help Find Madeleine messages on their websites. The disappearance of one little girl had provoked the most extraordinary outpouring of media interest over such a case in modern times. The result was something approaching mass hysteria. What a contrast with the pitiful response to Shannon Matthews' disappearance. After 2 weeks, the case had received a third of the media coverage given to McCann in the same period. There was no rolling news team from Dewsbury, no politicians wearing coloured ribbons, no Help Find Shannon messages flashing up on company websites. The relatively paltry sum of £25,500, though this later rose to £50,000, had been offered for her discovery, nearly all of which had been put up by the Sun. If money was anything to go by, the life of Madeleine McCann had been deemed 50 times more valuable than that of Shannon Matthews. Why Madeleine? Some commentators were remarkably honest about why, of all the injustices in the world, it was the tragedy of this one little girl that provoked such anguish. "This kind of thing doesn't usually happen to people like us," lamented Alison Pearson in the Daily Mail. What Pearson meant by people like her was people from comfortable middle-class backgrounds. Kidnappings, stabbings, murders, those are things you almost expected to happen to people living in Peckham or Glasgow. This sort of tragedy was not supposed to happen to folks you might bump into doing the weekly shop at Waitrose. Pearson's distress at Madeleine's plight was matched only by her lack of sympathy for the case of Shannon Matthews. And it was for the same reason. The little girl's background. Even as police were losing hope of finding Shannon alive, Alison Pearson launched into a smug broadside about her family circumstances. Like too many of today's kids, Shannon Matthews was already a victim of a chaotic domestic situation, inflicted by parents on their innocent children, long before she vanished into the chilly February night. It was Pearson's only foray into the case, but when the McCanns came under fire for leaving their small children alone in the holiday flat from which Madeleine was abducted, she was one of their strongest defenders. "The truth is that the McCanns were not negligent," she said decisively. "None of us should presume to judge them, for they will judge themselves horribly for the rest of their lives." This middle-class solidarity was shared by India Knight at the more upmarket Times. The resort the McCanns went to belongs to the Mark Warner Holiday Group, which specializes in providing family-friendly holidays to the middle classes, she confided. The joy of such a resort was that they were populated by recognizable types, where you could sigh in relief and think, everyone is like us. They were not places you would expect to meet the kind of people who wallop their weeping kids in Sainsbury's. These are revealing confessions. These columnists' undoubtedly sincere grief was not simply caused by the kidnapping of a little girl. They were distressed, basically, because she was middle class. It's easy to see why the McCann family were so appealing to middle-class journalists. The parents were medical professionals from a smart suburb in Leicestershire. They were regular churchgoers. As a couple, they were photogenic, well-groomed, and bursting with health. When pictured lovingly tending to their twin babies, they represented an almost idealized portrait of middle-class family life. Empathy for their plight came naturally to those like Alison Pearson and India Knight, because the McCanns' lives were similar to their own. The contrast with the Matthews family could not have been greater. Shannon grew up on an impoverished estate in an old industrial northern town. Her mother, Karen, had 7 children from relationships with 5 different men. She did not work, while her partner, Craig Meehan, was a supermarket fishmonger. Ms. Matthews appeared to the world in unfashionable clothing, her hair pulled back, her face dour, without makeup and looking strikingly older than her 32 years. A slouching Mr. Meehan stood next to her in a baseball cap, sweatshirt and tracksuit bottoms. They were definitely not people like us. The case simply could not provoke the same response among predominantly middle-class journalists. And it did not. Roy Greenslade, the former editor of the Daily Mirror, had no doubts about the dearth of media coverage. Overarching everything is social class. Was this unfair? It's difficult to explain why else, even in the first week of the Matthews disappearance, newspapers were still opting to give front-page coverage to possible sightings of Madeline 9 months after she had vanished. Shannon's background was just too far removed from the experience of journalists who covered such stories. You don't need to indulge in psychobabble to understand why those who write and broadcast our news were so fixated with Maddie, while displaying scant interest in a missing girl from a northern backwater. Dewsbury Moor is no home county's idyll, nor is it a Portuguese holiday resort, commented one journalist at the Times, in an effort to explain why there was no media frenzy over Shannon. It is up north, it is a bleak mix of pebble-dash council blocks and neglected wasteland, and it is populated by some people capable of confirming the worst stereotype and prejudice of the white underclass. He could hardly overlook the distress of some neighbours, but felt that others seemed only too ready to treat the drama of a missing child as a sort of exciting game that has relieved the monotony of life on the poverty line. Such comments open a window into the minds of educated middle-class hacks. They had stumbled into strange, unfamiliar territory. After all, they knew nobody who had grown up in these circumstances. It's no surprise that they found it difficult to empathize with them. I suspect in general a lot of national journalists, the people who will have gone up north to cover it, would have been entering an alien world, says senior Mirror journalist Kevin Maguire. It'll have been as alien to them as Kandahar or Timbuktu. They just wouldn't know that Britain, because it's not their Britain. It's not the bit they live in, they come from. This is not baseless speculation. The occasional journalist even confessed as much. Melanie Reed in the Times argued passionately that us deuce middle classes simply did not understand the case, because we are as removed from that kind of poverty as we are from events in Afghanistan. For life among the white working class of Dewsbury looks like a foreign country. The working-class residents of Dewsbury Moor were certainly painfully aware of the reasons behind the lack of interest in Shannon Matthews. They knew that many journalists had nothing but contempt for communities like their own. "Listen, we're not pissed out of our trees or high as a kite all the time. like they associate with council estates. Local community leader Julie Bushby angrily berated journalists. 90% of people here work. We've all taken money out of our own pockets for this. Aware of the contrasting response to the disappearance of the girl who had become affectionately known simply as Maddie, she added, "Two children have gone missing. That's the point. Everyone feels the same when that happens, rich, pauper, whatever. Good luck to Kate McCann. It's the kids we're looking for, isn't it? Not the mothers." But, as it was to turn out, there was a big difference between the two cases. Unlike Madeline McCann, Shannon was found alive on the 14th of March 2008. She had been kidnapped, tethered with a rope tied to a roof beam, hidden in a divan bed and drugged to keep her quiet. As far as the public was aware at that point, an estranged distant relative had snatched her. It was to be weeks before the true story emerged. Yet the knives were not out for the man believed to be the abductor, an eccentric loner who was the uncle of Karen Matthews' partner. In the firing line were Karen Matthews and, more importantly, the class she was taken to represent. With Shannon safe, it was no longer considered tasteless to openly lay into her community. The affair became a useful case study into Britain's indulgence of an amoral class. Her background, a scenario that encompasses the awful, dispiriting, and undisciplined face of Britain, should be read as a lesson in failure, one columnist wrote in the Birmingham Mail. Karen Matthews, 32 but looking 60, glib hair falling across a greasy face, is the product of a society which rewards fecklessness. Here was an opportunity to score fresh political points. Melanie Phillips is one of Britain's most notorious self-appointed moral arbiters, and an aggressive champion of what she sees as traditional values. To her, the Shannon Matthews case was a gift, vindicating what she'd been saying all along. Days after the girl was found, Phillips argued that the affair helped to reveal the existence of an underclass which is a world apart from the lives that most of us lead and the attitudes and social conventions that most of us take for granted. In a hysterical tirade, the writer alleged that there were whole communities where committed fathers are so rare that any child who actually has one risks being bullied, and where boys impregnate 2, 3, 4 girls with scarcely a second thought. No evidence was given in support of these allegations. In an increasingly poisonous atmosphere, some of the most extreme prejudices began to erupt into the open. In a debate on the case in March 2008, one Conservative councillor in Kent, John Ward, suggested that there is an increasingly strong case for compulsory sterilisation of all those who've had a second child or third or whatever while living off state benefits. When challenged, Mr. Ward was unrepentant about calling for the sterilisation of professional spongers, who he claimed breed for greed. Sounds familiar? Local Labour councillor Glyn Griffiths thinks so, telling me it is effectively Nazi eugenics, which is unacceptable in a Western democracy. But his horror was not shared by the dozens of Daily Mail readers who bombarded the newspaper with messages in support of the Tory councillor. "I fail to see the problem with his comments," wrote one, adding, "It is not a God-given right to mass-produce children." "What a great idea," wrote another well-wisher. "Let's see if the politicians are bold enough to adopt it." More practical contributors suggested starting a petition in support, while another came up with the imaginative proposal to lace the entire water supply with an infertility drug and then offer an antidote only to suitable parents. "No doubt the liberal lefties will be up in arms," added this perceptive contribution. "After all, they rely on the unemployed chavs to vote them into power." Yet another expressed their 100% agreement with Ward's proposals. "The country is sinking under the weight of these sponging bludgers." Of course, class prejudice isn't always as crude as this. Unhinged though some of these comments are, they undoubtedly reflect an undercurrent of hatred in British society. But this was only the tip of the iceberg. When the dark truth of the Matthews affair came to light, open season was declared on working-class communities like Dewsbury Moor. Over 3 weeks after her daughter had been found alive, Karen Matthews was dramatically arrested. In one of the most unimaginable crimes a mother could commit, she had kidnapped her own 9-year-old daughter to pocket the reward money, by then totaling £50,000. As if the case couldn't get any more surreal, Craig Meehan was charged with possessing child porn. "Which one of you lot is going to be arrested next?" mocked the crowd, gathered to watch the friends and relatives of Matthews as she appeared in court. Yet there was much more to the strange case of Shannon Matthews than an abusive parent who went to extraordinary lengths to use her own daughter for financial gain. The episode was like a flare, momentarily lighting up a world of class and prejudice in modern Britain. Of course, media intrigue was much more than justified by the unique horror of the case and the perverse manner in which Karen Matthews had deceived her community, the police, and the nation as a whole. And yet, for a whole host of media commentators and politicians, this was far from an isolated case, involving a depraved individual who shared guilt only with those who were directly complicit. "The case seems to confirm many prejudices about the underclass," reflected one local newspaper. It was as though everyone in the country from a similar background was crammed into the dock alongside her. Acting as the nation's judges, juries, and executioners, the tabloids turned on Dewsbury Moor. Local residents were fair game. After all, they had the audacity to live on the same street as Karen Matthews. The estate became a template for similar working-class